play, I would play my guitar, my sisters sang along. Sister's smile could always light up my daddy's face. But when they get to dancing, they dance all night and dawn. And I would sing one for sister, play one for papa, moan one for mama, and cry one for you. Mama liked the slow ones, she'd shuffle across the floor. Sister liked the fast ones, Lord, she could step so high. I can see my daddy dancing till he could dance no more. When I'd play a sad song, you would start to cry. And I would sing one for sister, play one for papa, moan one for mama, and I'd cry one for you. That's just me and this old guitar. I've no place to call my home. Mama and Papa have passed away, sisters settled down. You ran off and left me to live here all alone. Now all I play are sad old songs since you're leaving town. And I will sing one for sister, play one for Papa, moan one for mama, and cry one for you. Yes, I will sing one for sister, play one for Papa, moan one for mama, and cry one for you.
Robert Earl Keen on KPR, Sing One for Sister. Before that, the 5-Pound Bass, his 1989 album called West Textures, with Sierra Farrell up next. The 19-year-old Stella Prince with her new album after that, here on KPR. Hey, if it's not worth the time or effort to sell that old car, truck, or motorcycle, KPR's vehicle donation program will take it off your hands to turn it into the programs you love. Easy to donate your vehicle online at KansasPublicRadio.org. Here's Sierra Farrell and her album this year called Trail of Flowers, with a song called American Dreaming on KPR.
Wake up again in an old motel. Is it somewhere different? I can't tell. Every set of curtains opens to the open road. And I'm missing you like hell. This fan is like a prison cell. When I know you have gone with her and I can't go back home. I've been American dreaming. Oh, oh, I'm American dreaming. Oh, oh, I'm American dreaming. Oh, oh, but I never seem to get no rest. I should get some rest today, then pack my bags, be on my way. But my mind's always working on the way it could have been. Trying to tow a tightrope line, find a way to feel how fine, without drowning in this wine, calling you again. I've been American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American. don't you remind me who I am? If I could just get back home to pick up where we left off, I'd take better care of myself. I'd stop drinking from the bottom shelf, but my old wheels keep spinning and I cannot make them stop. I've been American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American dreaming. Oh, 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 but I never seem to get no rest. So I'll get back home and try to be someone that's something like me. But I've forgotten all my angels out here in the wind. Sitting idle with my mind, I meditate to pass the time. But there's something inside sitting saying all over again.
All is all alone.
Could you be the lighthouse for my soul? Could you be the one that I love so?
Sienna Farrell here on KPR. Two songs from her album this year on Rounder Records. The album Trail of Flowers, we heard American Dreaming, and then Lighthouse with the 19-year-old Stella Prince up next. Oklahoma singer-songwriter John Moreland in just a few minutes, and some classic early Gillian Welch on the way as well. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the law office of David J. Brown, LC in Lawrence, working to help individuals, small businesses, families, and non-traditional families with legal and estate planning needs, located at 120 East 9th Street in Lawrence. Well, Stella Prince came by and sang some songs at the KPR studios a couple of years back when she was 17. She's 19 now, and her new EP is called Dear Future Me. Let's hear that song from Stella Prince, a native of Woodstock, New York, who moved to Nashville last year.
What do I keep begging for love? Is it because I'm never enough? Why do I always punish myself if things don't go the way I plan them to be? You never truly recover when you always compare yourself to another. Childhood insecurities hover, making it hard to relate to each other. When will I feel maybe not until I get over past insecurities. Standing tall like trees, reaching new heights of maturity. I wish my younger self could see dear future me. I guess they're just not the kids I grew up with. I wish my old friends knew that I think of them often. They're probably living it up, going to parties, growing up, moving on without me, doing all the things we said we'd do. When will I feel this empty void that's buried deep inside?
Finally at the end of my road,
put-downs are clever, they're subtle but cutting. I didn't always see their intent. I finally realize the lies in your eyes reflect the wasted hours I've spent. So maybe in time you'll actually find I do in fact have something to say. I believe your excuses, but really the truth is I won't give my power away. You don't have to say whatever rudely comes to mind. You don't have to bury my confidence that you yourself can find. You don't.
Two songs from 19-year-old Stella Prince here on KPR, Dear Future Me and What's Mine, from her recently released five-song EP, Dear Future Me. That's Stella Prince with the new one this year from Oklahoma songwriter John Moreland. Up next, we'll have a great Gillian Welch song in about 10 minutes here on Trail Mix. We're here and we are, Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, online at kansaspublicradio.org. The news on KPR goes beyond sound bites and headlines. It's high-quality news and information that is in-depth and detailed and insightful. We're only able to do this through membership support. That great in-depth news and all the wonderful music here on KPR all comes because of support from individual listeners just like you. You make it happen with your membership support. Do that at kansaspublicradio.org. Here's John Moreland.
By now we all know how this goes. A digital mirage of home, candy apples painted chrome. I'm praying we can walk the wire and keep our feet above the fire. The news keeps steady coming in. Our condition shows its teeth again. A nightmare we all thought would end. How far is it for? Do we really want? Souls are filling up the streets, burning with the holy heat. But we don't grieve and we don't rest. We just choose the lie that feels the best. So leave the banners at half-mast until nature takes them down at last. The future, it is coming fast. The future, it is coming fast. Thank you. There was a time I thought I could make the pain stop. I ran every way but forward. I made a flood out of a raindrop. And you don't know how much I've been thinking about you. Well, you still got your nostalgia, and I got my wandering mind. I am a visitor. Everywhere I go, I am a visitor. Well, I don't need much but a healing touch. I am a visitor. The city's getting bigger while the world is getting smaller. I made a ransom note to heaven. I made a dime out of a dollar. And my half measures, well, they thrashed me half to death. So you just hang on to your half-truths, 'cause I got enough regrets. I am a visitor. Everywhere I've been, I am a visitor. Well, I don't need much but a healing touch. I am a visitor. Times of anything but kind. I've been dreaming like there's something there, a meaning I could find. But lost and found, round and round I go. Doing every bit I can with what little bit I know. I am a visitor. Been stoned and scared of my reflection. I can see your shifty smirk from the depths of my depression. But I will not be your puppet or your payment, your easy entertainment, for I've made amends to me. I am a visitor. On this lonely earth, I am a visitor. Well, I don't need much but a healing touch. No, I don't need much, just a healing touch. I am a visitor. I am a visitor. I'm only visiting.
John Moreland, and a lot of intimate and powerful songs on his new album, which he recorded almost all at home. John Moreland's album, Visitor. We just heard the song Visitor, and before that, the song The Future is Coming Fast. John Moreland on KPR. Gillian Welch is up next, and we've got a duo album from a fiddle player versed in American old-time music, Jane Rothfield, and a guitarist, Alan Carr, who's from Scotland. We'll hear their new album, some music from that in just a little bit here on Kansas Public Radio. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing automatic backup battery systems for uninterrupted power for residential homes or businesses. More information is at CromwellSolar.com. Well, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings are scheduled to play at the Folly Theater in Kansas City on September the 15th. Info and tickets at their website, FollyTheater.org. I thought we'd go back to the very early part of Gillian's career, her debut album, Revival, back in 1996, I'm thinking, and the song, Agony Bell. It's Gillian Welch on KPR. Gillian Welch with Agony Bell here on Kansas Public Radio. That is from her 1996 debut album that was called Revival. And Gillian Welch and David Rawlings have a new album that's out soon. Just have a single from that. So far, we'll play that single tomorrow. But do want to let you know that they're going to be in Kansas City at the Folly Theater on September the 15th, a 7:30 p.m. concert at the Folly in downtown Kansas City. Tickets and info at FollyTheater.com. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the Raven Bookstore. Independently serving the local community for over 30 years, the Raven Bookstore, located at 809 Mass Street in Lawrence, or online at ravenbookstore.com. Well, we're going to hear kind of a blend of old-time and Scottish and Irish music, old-time American music, Scottish and Irish music, from the duo The American Fiddler Janie Rothfeld, her longtime husband, the Scottish guitarist Alan Carr. They both sing as well. And their new album, by the way, their first album was in 1983. Their new album is called The Two of Us. Here's a tune called The Idlewild Jig. And then we'll hear one called Love is Teasing. It's at Janie Rothfeld and Alan Carr together on Kansas Public Radio.
least it's new. But as love grows older, it soon grows colder, fades away like the morning dew. I left my mother, I left my father, left them all for the love of you. I came so far to this wild country, trust in that your heart was true. If I had known before I courted that love would be such a killing crime, I'd have locked my heart in a box of gold, tied it up with a silver twine. I never thought that my love would leave me until one morning when she came in. She pulled up a chair, sat down beside me, then my sorrows, they did begin. So turn around, you wheel of fortune, turn around and smile on me. Surely there'll be one honest woman in this wide world who won't deceive me. Love is teasing, love is pleasing, love's a pleasure when first it's new. But as love grows older, it soon grows colder, fades away like the morning dew.
Janie Rothfeld and Alan Carr, their new album, The Two of Us, blending Celtic and old-time music. We heard the Idlewild Jig and then Love is Teasing for you here on Kansas Public Radio's Trail Mix.
Stardate July 27th. The center of the Milky Way galaxy is already packed with stars, but in a few million years, tens of thousands more could flare to life in a region known as the Brick. It's a vast cloud of cold, dark gas and dust that's shaped like a brick. It may be the biggest future star cluster in the entire galaxy. It's more than 100,000 times the mass of the Sun. And observations in recent years have shown that it contains dozens of dense blobs of material, cocoons that could be giving birth to stars even now. Stars are born when such blobs collapse under their own weight. As a blob collapses, it gets hotter. If it gets hot enough, nuclear fusion ignites in its core, giving birth to a star. There are indications that a few small stars have already formed in the Brick, but such giant clouds are also where big, heavy stars are born, stars that shine tens of thousands of times brighter than the Sun. It's not certain that the Brick will give birth to many stars at all. While it has the right ingredients, it's in the most crowded region of the galaxy. The gravity of the stars and clouds around it could keep it too stirred up to form stars. Powerful magnetic fields could hinder star formation as well. Astronomers will study the Brick in more detail in the coming years to determine whether it's the site of future fireworks or a galactic dud. Tomorrow, dawn encounters for the Moon. You can find more astronomy news in Stardate magazine. Subscription information at stardate.org. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
And for Kansas Public Radio, this is Bob McWilliams. You know, KPR listeners are engaged in their communities, and they frequent businesses that support public radio. Become a KPR sponsor and reach those most likely to take action at sponsorship.publicradio.org, sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
This week, on Live at Green Lady Lounge, it's two of KC's best guitar players, Danny Embry and Rod Fleeman, and their band Wiretown. David Bassey here. Hope you'll join us live at Green Lady Lounge, Saturday at 6 p.m. on KPR.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear some Private Eye Jazz, featuring Mickey Spillane as Detective Mike Hammer. Plus, can a cement mixer make music? I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me with the music Shaken, Not Stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour, Saturday night at 7 on KPR.
We're here and we are, Kansas Public Radio, from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg, Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Being here in Paris for the Olympics, there is no higher platform than where we are right now.
Swimming, beach volleyball, rugby, water polo, the Olympic Games are underway. We'll have the latest on the first full day. For Saturday, July 27th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, the latest on two deadly strikes in the Middle East, both of which left children among the casualties. We'll also look at the millions of dollars being wagered on who will join Vice President Kamala Harris on the Democratic ticket.
You can see big fluctuations in these markets whenever there's a rumored meeting between the vice president and a prospective candidate.
The latest on the two astronauts stuck orbiting Earth in the International Space Station.
We would employ those systems if we need to, but we really have our team focused on returning Butch and Sonny on Starliner.
Plus an interview with LeVar Burton. It's good. But hey, you don't have to take my word for it. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Vice President Harris says she's the underdog in the race for president, but predicts she and Democrats will win in November. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, she was speaking at her first fundraiser since becoming her party's likely candidate for president.
Harris tried to level set, telling supporters this race is going to be difficult. She described it as a choice between two visions for the country, one forward-looking and one that wants to take the country back.
Have you noticed, right, that somehow you're strong if you're a bully? Instead of what we all know, the true measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you lift up. Who you lift up.
Harris returned to a theme of freedom, freedom to vote, freedom from gun violence, and reproductive freedom. And hitting former President Trump and his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, she said some of the things they've been saying are, quote, weird. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Former President Trump campaigns in Minnesota tonight, where he is expected to sharpen his attacks on Harris. NPR's Franco Ordonez has more.
Former President Donald Trump will be joined by his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, where the two will try to regain the spotlight from Vice President Kamala Harris, who kicked off her campaign with great momentum. Trump has described her as more radical than President Biden and a danger to democracy. On Friday, he called her a bum and said she wants to impose San Francisco values on the country.
Harris will appoint hundreds of extreme far-left judges to forcibly impose crazy San Francisco liberal values on Americans nationwide.
But he has struggled to wrestle attention away from Harris, who has moved quickly to rally Democratic support behind her after President Biden exited the race. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
A rocket hit a sports complex where children were playing soccer in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights this afternoon. The Israeli military says it was launched from southern Lebanon by Hezbollah, but Hezbollah has denied responsibility. And here's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Israel says 40 rockets were fired from southern Lebanon by Hezbollah towards northern Israel earlier today, and that most of them were shot down. But one hit a soccer field where kids were playing. The Israeli ambulance service says that at least 11 people were killed, all of them children, and at least 29 more were injured, some critically. Hezbollah has denied responsibility. Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari called this the deadliest attack on Israeli civilians since October 7th. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, currently in Washington, D.C., was briefed on the situation and decided to return to Israel earlier than planned. There has been concern in recent months about a full-out war beginning between Hezbollah and Israel. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR. The Justice Department is defending the law that would force the sale of TikTok or ban the popular social media app in the U.S. over national security concerns, saying allowing TikTok to continue to be operated by its parent company could allow the Chinese government to covertly influence U.S. elections. The video sharing app sued the U.S. government in May over the law, arguing it's unconstitutional because it violates the First Amendment. In a federal appeals court filing, the DOJ says TikTok has manipulated content in the past, including at the direction of Beijing. Marvel has another superhero hit in the R-rated Deadpool and Wolverine. NPR's Bob Mondello says the film is already setting records.
With audiences limited to 17-year-olds or older, unless accompanied by a parent, Deadpool and Wolverine was only expected to set R-rated records, and it's done that.
Let's give the people what they came for!
New bests for R-rated previews, R-rated opening day, and it'll soon top the original Deadpool's record for R-rated weekend.
Stop it.
But the Marvel threequel is doing so well that it's crashing into mainstream record books. It now has the sixth biggest opening day overall, and it's heading for either the eighth or ninth biggest weekend.
This is what I'm talking about. Big slow-motion action sequence. Who knows if you live or die?
By Sunday evening, the potty-mouthed superheroes are expected to have amassed about $200 million in North America. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst. And you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 89 and clear. Wind is from the south-southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 70s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Wind will be from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. It's 89 and clear. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Millions of dollars are being wagered on who Kamala Harris will pick as her vice president. In a minute, we will hear from someone who studies political behavior on why keeping an eye on those bets is a useful tool. But first to Paris, where it is the first full day of the Summer Olympics. And one of the most highly anticipated swimming events of the Games just wrapped up, the women's 400-meter freestyle. It saw an American favorite, Katie Ledecky, come up short of a gold medal. Our All Things Considered co-host, Juana Summers, is part of the NPR team covering the action and joins us from Paris. And Juana, unless you tell me otherwise, I'm going to assume you are doing this hit from the perch on the Eiffel Tower that Celine Dion sang from last night.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Glass of wine and baguette in hand.
Excellent. That is fact going forward. But let's talk about this race. Work ground to a halt at All Things Considered. We all stopped to watch it. Walk us through what happened.
Scott, I mean, no matter what happened, this was always going to be such an incredible race between Australia's Ariane Titmus defending her Olympic title, Katie Ledecky, and Canada's Summer McIntosh. Titmus pulled away from the field early. Her lead kept growing over the course of the eight laps. And by lap five, Scott, she had gained, get this, an entire body length on Ledecky. Titmus took the win with McIntosh in second place, less than 1 second behind Titmus. Ledecky came in behind both of them 3 seconds later, likely not the result she was hoping for. before, but that still put her back on the podium for her 11th career Olympic medal. And believe it or not, this was just her first bronze medal.
I mean, Titmus was amazing. What did she say afterward about defending gold medal at this event?
Yeah, Scott, so she told reporters that she was really relieved more than anything else, and she said that she probably felt the expectation and pressure for this race more than anything in her whole life. She also spoke very warmly of her rivalry with Katie Ledecky, saying that that rivalry just really doesn't exist beyond the races. She also said she admired Ledecky's longevity in the sport. We should point out this is Katie Ledecky's fourth Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out here that if you, like all of us, were watching this race intently, this is not the last time we are going to see Titmus and Ledecky face off. We will be seeing these two again real soon at the 800-meter freestyle that's happening next weekend.
I'm excited to see that. And there was action all over Paris today. What else were you and the team keeping track of?
Well, I got to tell you, there was a whole lot to keep us busy. Early on in the day, the United States won the first medal of the Paris Olympics when Sarah Bacon and Cassidy Cook took silver in women's synchronized 3-meter diving competition. And that's the first time Team USA has medaled in that event since the 2012 games. And yesterday on the show, folks may remember that we introduced you to Ashley Johnson, a member of the U.S. water polo team. And I just want to say that team today had no trouble demolishing Greece. Big win there. Water polo in the hunt for a fourth straight gold. And I also just want to drop a brief update here for a story that our team has been following that has to do with the Canadian soccer team using a drone to spy on opponents. Today, FIFA, which is soccer world governing body, suspended the head coach for a year, as well as two former officials on the team. And in addition, FIFA deducted 6 points from the team in the Olympic women's soccer competition, which all but guarantees Canada is not going to be able to medal here.
Wow. I mean, other than Celine Dion's phenomenal performance, I feel like the highlight of the opening ceremonies was that unfortunate pouring rain. Is the weather any better today?
It is. I did not have to keep my raincoat on all day like I did last night, but I have to say the clear skies are here now, but weather conditions did force schedule changes during the first full day of the games. The first skateboarding event, men's street skateboarding, was postponed due to the rain. A bunch of tennis matches were delayed or postponed as well. Road conditions were also quite tough for cyclists who were battling slick conditions. There was one participant in the Olympic cycling individual time trial, Taylor Nibb, who actually fell several times in those wet conditions. That's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were also some lingering conditions about what impact all of this rain that we've been seeing here in Paris could have on the water quality for swimming in the Seine, with the triathlon set to begin Tuesday.
Lastly, this is your first Olympics. I am insanely jealous, but very happy for you. What are you looking forward to over the next few days?
I mean, the coolest thing about covering the Olympics is that everything is sort of a dream assignment. One thing I'm keeping my eye on is the U.S. women's Olympic basketball team. They are going after a record 8th consecutive Olympic gold. So looking forward to see what's happening. That roster is just absolutely stacked, and looking forward to see what those players will do.
Juana Summers, thank you so much.
For us, we just stay together collectively.
Who is Vice President Harris going to pick as her running mate? It is a question political obsessives are following, and it's also a question a lot of gamblers are tracking and betting on. Millions of dollars are being wagered on whether Harris will pick Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, or someone else. This latest opportunity bet is just one more moment in an election where, according to Bloomberg News, more than $366 million have already been wagered. Tom Wood is a professor of political science at a school that an already named vice presidential candidate makes a point to call the Ohio State University. He studies political behavior and is here to break this down. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into this, can you just quickly explain how this works? Because that in itself is really interesting. How similar or different is this to sports betting?
It's, from a mathematical perspective, it's identical. Mm-hmm. And this is how I sort of motivate it for students. You can imagine an individual bettor has financial motivations to set aside their personal feelings about the two particular teams playing, and instead to soberly assess the available evidence and make the best bet to protect their own financial circumstance. And people betting on election outcomes are doing the exact same process of information integration. Yeah. It's even pretty similar to the way people trade financial derivatives on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. But how are these bets taking place? Because this is not technically a legal thing you can do, like a sports bet, right?
Sure. So there are tiny academic markets in the United States. The University of Iowa had an exchange for academic purposes, and then Predictit came along and now works with the University of Iowa. But the huge sums of money being bet are being placed on bookmakers abroad, mostly the UK, Australia, Ireland, where betting on politics is regulated exactly the same way that you could bet on who's going to win an Oscar or who's going to win the Australian Football League in that particular year. And so we might be curious as to which kinds of people are participating in these markets.
Yeah.
It is, of course, illegal for Americans to participate directly in those markets, but I'd invite your listeners to think about the ease with which people can use things like VPNs and the simulated credit card with a foreign billing address. And so it's probably the case that a large number of Americans are participating in these overseas betting markets.
Not that we're endorsing that, I will just say.
Of course not. Right, yes.
Minors, but,
of course.
But yeah, this is something that has grown election after election after election. I'm curious, have you taken a look at how accurate the markets typically are compared to the eventual results? Are these things that we should be looking at like we look at polls?
So there's a very large literature on the respective accuracy of polling and markets, and they find that markets tend to consistently outperform. So you might imagine that in addition to reading elite American press and listening to NPR to integrate political news, it's probably also the case that people who bet on these markets have read at least a fair smattering of the academic research on campaign effects, the role of the economy in harming or helping incumbent candidates. So it's really a pretty interesting and efficient way to integrate all those different sources of information to make the best sort of bet on from an individual's perspective.
The interesting thing about Kamala Harris selecting a vice president is that this is not something that was anticipated until very recently. There is a lightning fast veep stakes happening over the course of weeks. You've been keeping tabs on the markets. What has stood out to you? What activity have you been seeing?
A couple of things. So on the first blush, you'd say that folks participating in this particular market are very shrewd observers of American politics insofar as the demographic composition of the candidates who are doing very well in the veep stakes market, they're all white men. And so they're reflecting this idea that Kamala Harris faces some sort of strategic demographic imperative to balance her role at the top of the ticket with some sort of salve to political moderates. And so Mark Kelly's doing very well, Josh Shapiro, Roy Cooper, Andy Beshear, Pete Buttigieg. And it's also impressive the extent to which people are paying a ton of attention to the individual movements of the candidate and the rumors. You can see big fluctuations in these markets whenever there's a rumored meeting between the vice president and a prospective candidate. And so, by the time Kamala Harris has made a choice, we'll have minimal polling data to help us track this choice. So if you are really a political tragic and you want to follow moment by moment, you could do a lot worse than simply refresh your local bookmaker's odds sheet.
You know, there was an interesting scandal in the British election where a political advisor who may have had inside information about when the election was going to be called placed a bet on what day the election would be called for and won that bet, but triggered an investigation right away. And I think that leads to a question of there's so much money at stake here. Any concern that this could corrupt the process or lead to people making political decisions to win money?
So, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I think the one thing that probably protects us in this system is just how ideologically motivated American politicians are. The idea that they would act differently to protect a bet rather than just to maximize their chances of having political influence. I definitely don't think that elected officials themselves are likely playing in these markets. But yeah, I share it is a concern. If a staffer, if a person who regards politics as their vocation rather than a battle of ideological opportunities, that person might have an opportunity to trade that information. But that also is what makes these markets so fascinating. There probably is people inadvertently divulging private information like on these marketplaces. And so we might think of that as weirdly as another way in which these markets have some prognostic accuracy.
That's Tom Wood, political science professor at Ohio State University. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from Blue Collar Press. Located in Lawrence, Kansas, Blue Collar Press helps businesses and creatives build their brands through merchandising, from design to production to fulfillment. More information at bluecollarpress.com. And Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. A chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Tonight, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, a low of 69. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 92. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel says at least 11 people were killed by a rocket strike on a soccer field in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. Officials call it the deadliest attack on Israeli civilians since the October 7th attack. Israel blames Hezbollah for the strike on the soccer field, but the militant group denies it. In France, transportation officials say the high-speed rail networks have been partially restored after yesterday's arson attack ahead of the Olympics opening ceremony. No one's claimed responsibility. And Marvel has another superhero hit in the R-rated Deadpool and Wolverine as the film sets records. The Marvel threequel has the sixth biggest opening overall. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback Wilderness. With standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and all-terrain tires, it's designed for paths not yet taken. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Children were the main casualties in two different strikes today, one in Gaza and another near Israel's northern border with Lebanon. The Gaza strike happened this morning at yet another school sheltering displaced people. It killed at least 30 Palestinians, many children, and wounded more than 100, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health. And in a different strike today near the Lebanon border, Israeli officials are saying children were also among the dead in a reported rocket strike targeting Israel. We're joined now by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv, who has been following both of these stories. And as a warning, there will be graphic descriptions of both scenes. Hey, Kat.
Hey, Scott.
Let's start in Gaza. What can you tell us about the Israeli airstrike there?
So this was on a school in the central city of Deir el-Balah. It's where many Palestinians have fled as evacuation orders from the Israeli military continue to increase around Gaza. The area is super overcrowded. This school had more than 4,000 people sheltering in it. Wow. It was also operating as a field hospital, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, and that was part of what was hit. More than 30 people were killed and scores more were wounded, many very seriously. The hospital morgue where those bodies were taken said there were at least 15 children killed and 8 women.
As has often been the case, our own producer, Anas Baba, was one of the first journalists on the scene documenting this. Yeah. What did he have to report?
Yeah, Anas is staying nearby, and again, thankfully, he's okay. But he got there just minutes after the strike, and he started almost immediately sending us video. You know, it was chaos. Here's a part of a voice memo that Anas sent.
Everything is in a mess. Nothing is still the same. Blood everywhere. You can find pieces of flesh on the stars and everywhere that you can see.
You know, he described handicapped people trying to flee. Remember, this was a field hospital. Mm-hmm. He also sent videos that showed wounded children being carried away on donkey carts, people carrying dead bodies on makeshift stretchers made out of pieces of debris. A few ambulances were on the scene, but they were swamped. Medical services are increasingly hard to come by in Gaza due to a lack of medical supplies and facilities. And even gas for ambulances is really hard to find. One woman Anas tried to stop for an interview was carrying a baby on her shoulder, and she just said this as she passed him.
ولحتى الآن لسه في صواريخ مش منفجرة.
She said there are missiles that haven't exploded. We need to leave. Anas then went to the hospital where the dead and injured were being taken, and he sent videos of hallways lined with bodies, many of dead children.
What's the Israeli military's response?
The Israeli military put out a statement saying that there was intelligence that Hamas was operating from the school, that they had been using the compound as a hiding place to plan attacks on Israeli forces. They also said that they had taken numerous steps to, quote, mitigate the risk of harming civilians, like using, quote, appropriate munitions. But again, this was a school housing some 4,000 people, and they were given no warning. Strikes by the Israeli military on schools housing displaced people in Gaza have become a pattern in recent weeks, and nearly the same statement is given each time.
And as we mentioned, this wasn't the only major incident today. We're hearing about a rocket that hit a sporting facility in the north close to the Lebanese border. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so we're still gathering information about what happened, but it hit the city of Majd al-Shams. It's in the Golan Heights, which is a disputed area that Israel seized from Syria in 1967 and claims as its own. This is a largely Druze community. It's an Arab minority group, some of whom are Israeli citizens. Israel says 40 rockets were fired from southern Lebanon by Hezbollah into northern Israel earlier today, and that most of them were shot down, but one hit a soccer field where kids were playing. The Israeli ambulance service says that at least 10 people were killed, all of them children, and at least 29 more were injured, some critically. Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari called this the deadliest attack on Israeli civilians since October 7th. That's the day of the Hamas-led attack on Israel that sparked the current war in Gaza. Hezbollah has put out a statement categorically denying responsibility for the attack, saying that they had, quote, absolutely nothing to do with the incident. But then the Israeli military responded, saying that it was Hezbollah. So it's all still a little unclear.
There's been so much tension between Israel and Hezbollah, and there's been concern for a long time now about an entirely different all-out war between the two of them. What could this mean for that?
Yeah, so this would be the largest number of civilian casualties by far in a Hezbollah attack since this kind of low-grade war started between the two last October, if in fact Hezbollah is to blame. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he's currently where you are, Scott, in Washington, D.C. He was briefed on this strike up north, and we're told he's holding security meetings about the situation. It's still too early to tell really what could happen, but it's possible this could trigger a much tougher Israeli response on Hezbollah than we've seen in recent months.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting from Tel Aviv with reporting from NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, as well. Thank you, Kat.
Thanks, Scott.
NASA says it still isn't sure when two of its astronauts can return home from the International Space Station. They went up to the outpost on a test flight of a brand new spaceship built by Boeing called Starliner. As NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, glitches during Starliner's flight have forced mission managers to spend a lot of time troubleshooting to make sure the vehicle is safe to come home.
These days, NASA relies on commercial space vehicles to take astronauts to the station. They're like space taxis. SpaceX launched the first one. NASA has been using it for years. But Boeing has been building one, too. And on June 5th, an Atlas V rocket launched from Florida with Starliner.
3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V. Carrying two American heroes.
Those heroes were astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore. NASA and Boeing originally said the test flight would last about a week.
I think we all knew that it was going to go longer than that.
That's Mark Nappy, the vice president and program manager for commercial crew at Boeing.
It's my regret that we didn't just say we're going to stay up there until we get everything done that we want to go do.
Because weeks and weeks have gone by. Here's what happened. Just before Starliner docked with the station, some of its thrusters inexplicably conked out. Mission managers also saw helium leaks. The two astronauts are safe on board the station. NASA stresses that they are not stranded there. They are working and floating around with the station's regular crew. Meanwhile, mission managers on the ground have been trying to understand Starliner's issues. To try to recreate what was seen in flight, workers have run exhaustive tests using spare hardware. Nappy says they think they now understand the root cause of both the thruster and the helium leak issues, and all of that will be reviewed extensively by NASA.
I'm very confident we have a good vehicle to bring the crew back with. We have to take the next steps to show that information to everybody else, and that leads up to the agency review. And that's what we're going to do over the next week.
The manager of NASA's Commercial Crew program is Steve Stitch. He says because there's another vehicle available, the SpaceX capsule, there are contingency plans if the agency decides Starliner shouldn't carry the astronauts back.
And we would employ those systems if we need to, but we really have our team focused on returning Butch and Sunny on Starliner.
He says they're methodically working through the data. Starliner has enough battery power to stay up in space through early September. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Police officers in Minneapolis are getting a big pay bump, more than 20% over the next 3 years. It's one of the latest police departments across the U.S. offering higher pay to help solve an understaffing problem. But as NPR's Meg Anderson reports, many say it takes far more than money to draw people to policing and to keep them there.
When Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara took over the department in 2022, he says it was like walking into a funeral parlor.
People weren't even talking to each other, and a lot of members were openly telling me, yeah, if somebody asked me they're thinking about becoming a cop, I'd tell them, no way, don't come here. Everybody hates us. Everyone is leaving. Go anywhere else but Minneapolis.
After all, this is the city where an officer killed George Floyd, sparking protests against police brutality. O'Hara estimates that today the department is staffed 40% below what it was in 2020.
For the community, it means much longer response times for certain things. Doesn't mean that we're forgetting about cases, but it does mean we are prioritizing.
More police and more money spent on policing doesn't necessarily predict crime. But since 2020, police forces in major cities across the country have shrunk.
It is a sign of the times.
Chuck Wexler heads the Police Executive Research Forum, a nonprofit that studies policing. He says the number of officers employed by large agencies nationwide is around 5% lower than it was 4 years ago.
The challenge of American policing right now is you have more resignations and retirements and less people who want to become police officers. So departments have had to try to incentivize,
meaning money. In many U.S. cities, officers are getting signing bonuses and pay hikes. In Washington, D.C., new officers get $25,000 just for being hired. Seattle boosted salaries this year by 23%. In Kansas City, it was 30%. Here's Chief O'Hara in Minneapolis again.
If we want quality policing, we're going to have to pay quality wages. It is just an extremely difficult job, and there just are not people interested in this.
But researchers who study policing say higher pay isn't all that effective at getting more people to become cops. Many former officers say they didn't leave because of the money. One told me he felt hated for the bad actions of officers across the country. Another said job stress made him lash out at his kids for little things. Compared to the general population, police officers are more likely to experience PTSD. They're also more likely to die by suicide. But there are cities bucking the trend. Some smaller departments have more officers now than they did in 2020. In Bloomington, Minnesota, a suburb just a few miles south of Minneapolis, the department is overstaffed.
I've done this job for less than a year. Every day is challenging.
Officer Devin Barnum is 23 years old. He graduated from college last year.
Bloomington was for sure my number one option. You know, I'm from here. I played sports here. I care about this community a lot.
On a recent afternoon patrol, he answered call after call. A dispute between a mom and her son.
Take a deep breath and give us a call.
A welfare check on a woman who didn't show up for work.
Department.
A call to secure an apartment building.
Once we have everything locked down, we are going to be systematically clearing each building looking for this armed felon.
As we drive, I ask Barnum about how he's feeling so far.
Yeah, obviously, I would say it's an extremely stressful job, right? The things you see in this job are like the average person doesn't see them.
Could more money have lured him to a different department?
No, I'm not going anywhere. We have our community support. Our chief is awesome. You don't get into this job for money.
Barnum's boss, the one he just called awesome, that would be Bloomington Police Chief Booker Hodges.
Everybody's got to do what they got to do, but I don't fundamentally believe that paying people these incentives works.
To be clear, Bloomington has increased officer pay, too, by about 3% a year for the last few years. That's more or less in line with cost of living increases. Chief Hodges says he has no plans for anything more than that.
I want people here who are here for a purpose, because purpose is going to transcend money. Now, granted, people need to get paid. I ain't naive to that, but purpose is going to keep people working. Purpose is going to get you through those tough times.
Hodges used to be president of the Minneapolis NAACP. He understands not everyone is going to like the police. He's aiming instead for mutual respect toward the community, but also toward officers. He says that makes for a positive work environment. Otherwise, understaffing, which leads to lots of overtime, can become a vicious cycle.
If you consistently have to work 16-hour days, one, how awake are you going to be, right? Two, how much quality time are you able to take to recharge and spend with your family, right? So are you your best person overall if you're working that much? And the answer is no.
He says you want the police that are out there to be healthy and happy and not just in it for the money. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Tortillas aren't just delicious. They can also save lives. True story.
There was a barn owl that needed picked up. It was possibly wrapped in a tortilla. You know, of course, you're instantly invested in that.
Amy Smith is an animal rehabber with the Wild West Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Amarillo, Texas. She was dispatched to a home where an abandoned baby bird, Mississippi Kite, was being kept alive by the warmth of a tortilla.
Pulled up and this wonderful family walked out with this swaddled burrito baby kite. And I thought it was the cutest thing ever. And just to see this tiny little bird just swaddled like a baby in this flour tortilla.
The Adlong family was hosting a barbecue and pool party at their home when Katie Adlong found the bird on the ground, shivering.
I picked it up. It started chirping. And so that's when I was like, oh my gosh, I looked at my friend and I was like, this is a baby bird. And I did a Google search. I was like, what to do if you find a baby bird? And it said, call your wildlife place. And so I just Googled wildlife center close near me.
Then she called.
So I had to tell her, like, I am holding this baby. And she goes, oh, that's perfectly fine. She was like, did you put it in like a warming box? And I was like, no, I wrapped it in a tortilla. The phone call went silent.
Why a tortilla? Adlong says the choice came down to pragmatism.
Honestly, it was all I had. You know, we had been in the pool, and so we were wet, and she had been shaking because she was cold. And so my husband and our friends were grilling on the grill, and he had slapped the tortilla down and was like, Katie, so, I'll take that tortilla. And he handed it to me, and I just swaddled Taquito up in it, and I was like, it's a baby blanket.
That's right. They named her Taquito, and Adlong took great care of her.
I did like a burrito wrap. I kind of tied the bottom in and rolled the side. I mean, literally, she looked like a swaddled baby.
Amy Smith of the Wildlife Center says the decision was probably life-saving.
She was pretty weak at that time, and it was really a life-saving type situation because of how weak and small and cold she was. You know, we have to maintain that body heat. So it was quick thinking, you know, and potentially saving her life.
Taquito's doing pretty well now. She even joined our interview over Zoom.
There she is. She is sitting in my hand. She is looking at the video that we're doing, just kind of taking in her surroundings and just kind of resting. She just had a very full meal, so her eyes look a little tired, but just sitting in the palm of my hand, just taking it all in.
Smith says it is common for young birds to fall.
So as the bird leaves the nest, you're in learning to fly. Being on the ground is part of that juvenile stage.
And if you find an abandoned baby bird, Smith has some tips.
Now, if there are no parents around that are still taking care of that baby because they're going to continue to help feed it, or if there's a multitude of cats or in danger, then you're definitely going to want to, you know, just grab a blanket and wrap that up and bring it to your local wildlife rehabber for sure.
Or, you know, use a tortilla. That was Amy Smith of the Wild West Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. We also heard from Katie Adlong and also Taquito. Well, kind of. This is NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Kansas City's Wiretown features two of the city's finest guitarists, Brian Baggett and Danny Embry. They're in the spotlight on tonight's Live at Green Liddy Lounge. Do join us for an hour of KC Jazz Originals on Live at Green Liddy Lounge. That's this evening at 6 on KPR 1. If you're listening over on KPR 2, it'll be the BBC World Service. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 20% chance of isolated showers, a low of 69. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 92. A chance of showers Sunday night, lows in the mid-70s. And by Monday, sunny and hot with a high near 100. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. An Israeli airstrike on a school in Gaza where thousands were sheltering from the ongoing war killed at least 30 people, including children. Israel says it was targeting a Hamas command center. Hamas denies the claim. Fire crews in California are battling the huge Park Fire, which has burned nearly 350,000 acres in Butte County. It's being fueled by dry vegetation and strong wind. Scores of buildings have been destroyed. In Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Vice President Harris used her first fundraiser since becoming the Democrats' likely presidential nominee to outline the differences between her and former President Trump, saying she's the underdog, but that she can defeat him. She's expected to raise more than $1.4 million at the fundraiser. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Among the many Democratic Party insiders who publicly or privately urged Joe Biden to reconsider running for president again, one played an outsized role.
It's up to the president to decide if he is going to run. We're all encouraging him to make that decision because time is running short.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went on MSNBC's Morning Joe, a show that Biden is known to watch, urging the president to make a decision. That got a lot of attention because at that point, Biden had said repeatedly he had made a decision to stay in the race. According to a lot of behind-the-scenes reporting, Pelosi also spoke with fellow members of Congress and major donors and eventually the president himself, expressing concern about polls that showed Biden was losing ground in swing states he needed to win. Eventually, Biden got that message.
Nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition.
Nancy Pelosi is herself 84 years old. That's older than President Biden. She's no longer in House leadership, and yet she remains a highly effective leader within the Democratic Party. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis has followed Pelosi's career. Hey, Sue.
Hey there.
So regardless of the exact details of who Pelosi called when, I think these past few weeks have really underscored how singularly powerful she remains within the Democratic Party, even though she's not minority leader anymore.
I think that's right. I think if you go back to the evening of the first presidential debate, when it became pretty clear that this campaign was going to have a problem, Democrats had hit the panic button.
Yeah.
And who do Democrats call when they hit the panic button, especially if the panic is about the president? And the answer was pretty quickly Nancy Pelosi. If you talk to lawmakers on the Hill, certainly donors, the sense of going to her and saying, what do you think this means? Can he still win? I'm worried about my district. All those, what they call frontline Democrats, the ones in the swing seats that'll help determine the majority next year. She's a first point person you call to get political advice. I think the one thing that's not disputed about Nancy Pelosi is she's pretty good political skills, and people still respect her take on this. I do think it was notable to me that an aide was quoted in the LA Times making clear that she wasn't making calls, she was taking calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right. I think that she served as sort of a vessel for Democrats to come to with their panic, and also in a way, a bit of a green light to say you can go public with this. Just one example of that is when Adam Schiff, fellow California Democrat, one of her top allies in Congress, who's also a candidate for the Senate, when he put out a statement calling on Joe Biden to step aside, it was very widely seen as something that would have had the blessing of Nancy Pelosi, because there's no way he would have made a statement like that without calling her first.
Right. What played out publicly was often very subtle, and yet it was very powerful. And let's go back to that Morning Joe appearance, because I think I gasped seeing that quote. And I think a lot of observers would have said she wasn't saying get out of the race now, but she said a lot by not saying that much. Can we just talk about why that was such a key public moment?
Yes, and I think it's so key to how Pelosi does things, because if you look back at all of her public statements, she never publicly suggested Joe Biden should get out of this race. She said he will make a decision and we'll go with what he does. Time is running short. He has a decision to make, some version of that. But it left the door open. And like you said, when you gasped when you heard it, I was in an email exchange with a Democratic staffer on the Hill, and they were basically saying, look, like, it's over. He's staying in the race. Like, we're just going to have to deal with it. And then immediately was like, never mind. Someone just sent me what Nancy Pelosi said on Morning Joe. The door's back open again. Like, her doing that, especially when you consider it was the same venue that Joe Biden had gone on a day or two previously to assert that he was not getting out of the race, the choice to use the same media platform to say, hey, maybe he has a decision to make, was, it sort of heard all over Washington. I also think you have to remember that these two people are friends.
Yeah.
They have a shared Catholic faith. They have two of the longest tenures in Washington politics. Most of the greatest legislative successes in their careers have relied on one another. They have a certain bond, or at least a certain relationship, that Biden doesn't really share, at least with any living, currently serving Democrats in Congress.
I think with a lot of political leaders, you see them gradually lose power. I think President Biden is a pretty prominent example of that this particular week. But I feel like with Pelosi, there has been a consolidating of power and also an appreciation of the power that she has that has increased over the years. Like, there was this whole, when I was covering the Hill with you, when the Democrats regained control of the House in 2018, there was this brief moment of media chatter of, will she have the votes to become speaker? Of course she became speaker. She immediately really positions herself in a way that she was standing up to Donald Trump, blocking Trump policies, gaining power. Is it that she has consolidated power, or just there's been an appreciation of time of, wow, look at how much this person did?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's also because Nancy Pelosi knows what it's like to relinquish power when maybe you weren't entirely ready, but you could tell it was time.
Mm-hmm.
When they lost the majority and she made clear that she would not run for leadership anymore, she actually said the words, she's going to help the next generation or the new generation of leaders. She has, by all accounts, I think, really tried to stay in the shadows in this Congress. She has tried to be like a helper for Hakeem Jeffries, the new Democratic leader. I don't think she's wanted to be seen as like constantly the mom constantly popping her head in the door to see if the kids are doing okay. But I do think that because she gave up that power, people still go to her for her opinion.
Yeah. One of the things you and others have pointed out over the years is that Pelosi is partially effective because she truly doesn't care what her national approval rating is. She doesn't need to be charismatic on television. And that's kind of unique in national politics in 2024.
I don't know if it's unique in politics, but I think it's unique to the people that are seen as truly powerful within politics.
Yeah.
And I would put in this column with Pelosi people like former Senate leader Harry Reid of Nevada and current Senate minority leader Mitch McConnell are all sort of seen as these three titans of Congress who are known for both their political instincts and their ability to get policy done. And all three sort of known for not particularly caring about what the media says about them, whether they're popular or not, but whether they were effective and whether they could get things done. And I think part of that is they were willing to be criticized if it helped other people in the party, mm-hmm. right? I think she would argue, and I think people like Mitch McConnell would argue, is somebody has to be willing to do the unpopular things to get things done. Mm-hmm. And that takes leadership. And not a lot of people in politics either have the skill to do it or the willingness to do it. And I think that is one thing that makes her unique, especially, frankly, as the only woman to have ever done it. And now, especially with Kamala Harris, the nominee, you have this really interesting power dynamic of Pelosi still being relevant on the Hill and now having the first multiracial female candidate for president.
Any sense in terms of what comes next if Harris wins in November? Harris, like Pelosi, comes from California politics, comes from San Francisco politics. Any sense what their relationship is and what that relationship could be like if Harris is in the White House and Pelosi is still in name a backbencher, but clearly not in Congress?
I mean, it's certainly not as warm of a relationship as it was with the late Dianne Feinstein of California, who was like family to Nancy Pelosi, but they've clearly known each other for decades through California politics. What I think is interesting now is if you go back a little bit to the 2016 election, Pelosi was intending to retire after that election. She has since said that publicly, that she thought Hillary Clinton was going to be the first female president of the United States, and that would be sort of a capstone on Nancy Pelosi's career, and she could bow out. Obviously, history didn't play out that way. I think as we sit here today, Nancy Pelosi still sees her purpose in life to defeat Donald Trump and not allow his return to power. So I think that's probably more her direct mission. But if in a world where Kamala Harris wins, I think to me, part of the question is, does Kamala Harris call Nancy Pelosi and say, you know, I hope you're not going anywhere?
Political correspondent Susan Davis, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
LeVar Burton knows he will be remembered for three specific roles, playing Kunta Kinte on the TV series Roots, donning a futuristic visor to become Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation, and perhaps most importantly for millennials and Gen Xers, hosting Reading Rainbow. Burton has embraced the fact that so many people strongly associate him with those roles, as he told NPR's Rachel Martin. Burton appeared on NPR's Wildcard, the show where guests answer questions at random from a deck of cards. Questions about the memories, insights, and beliefs that shape their life. Here's Rachel.
Round one memories. Ready?
Ready.
Okay, let's go. So, three cards,
yeah,
and you pick one, two, or three.
Three.
Oh, what do you admire about your teenage self?
My teenage self had this unshakable belief that everything was going to work out okay. That everything was just going to be fine, you know. That I was going to, you know, move to Los Angeles, study theater, graduate with a degree, move to New York, hustle my way onto the Broadway stage, and, you know, and have a career inspired by Ben Vereen, right?
I mean, you sort of did that.
Well, yeah.
So it wasn't like false confidence.
No, but that's what I admire about that kid.
Mm, mm.
That's what I admire about him.
Yeah.
You know, the odds were so stacked against him, and had he really understood what his expectations were, I mean, really understood them in terms of the real world and how things generally work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he was focused and he trusted. And boy, did he manifest.
We are on to round two. In this round, we're focused on insights, mm-hmm. stuff you're working through right now. Three new cards. Pick a card. One, two, three.
I want to go one.
Feeling one.
I am.
Has your idea of success changed over time?
Yes.
Oh.
I used to embody success unconsciously by how busy I felt mm-hmm. and how busy I was. Now, I feel that success is spending my time well, which, and what that means to me, what that looks like is a balance of work and leisure, work and rest, mm-hmm. because I recognize at this stage in my life that although I have a lot of energy, there's a limit to it. And the older I get, the more important it is for me to create that balance of activity and recuperation.
Yeah.
My job, I've come to the conclusion that my job is to be LeVar Burton, and I love my job. And as it happens, my job requires a lot of energy going out, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's energy output.
You get that.
And unless I recharge this battery, mm-hmm. it's not good.
It's interesting, though. You got so high so fast, right? Mm. Like, after Roots, you were up here.
I was 19.
Yeah, you're 19. And you're still like a kid. And so I wonder if your definition of success, that epiphany of realizing you need balance, you got to conserve, you can't just soar or you'll burn out. I wonder if that had
That was
to
experiential.
Evolve.
Yeah. I had to learn that.
Because that's a long life, God willing.
Exactly. And I think one of the gifts of Roots was that I had to come to terms with, you know what? I may never do anything as big or as important or as impactful as this, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm 19. You just need to manage your expectations. No, seriously,
yeah.
about what's going to happen next, because clearly, A, you don't know, and B, chances are this may be the pinnacle. It may be. So, yeah.
It wasn't. There were many
no, it turned out not yeah. to be. Right?
Yeah.
And that's the miracle of my life, yeah. that it wasn't the only leg on my stool. I have these three jewels, I call them, yeah. in my career crown, in Roots, in Reading Rainbow, and in Star Trek. And I think the part of the beauty of that journey for me is seeing that as a storyteller, I've been able to portray the black experience in America from our enslavement to the stars. Mm-hmm. And LeVar, the Reading Rainbow guy, is absolutely in the middle of that continuum. And so to really plot the trajectory of black people through time and space in this roughly 20th, 21st century time frame.
Wow, that's very profound.
Yeah.
What a gift.
Yeah, what a gift.
Yeah, what a gift.
What a gift. Who gets to do that? Mm-hmm. I do.
Mm. Okay, we are on round three. This is the final round, and for this one, we're getting into the big stuff, the really big stuff. Three new cards.
Yep.
One, two, three.
One.
One. Have your feelings about God or a divine power changed over time?
Mm-hmm. They have. I was raised a Catholic. And so I was raised with the idea of God as vehicle for punishment. Right?
Yeah.
And that has definitely changed over time. I'm much more in the camp of we are a part of God. God is a part of us, right? We are spiritual beings looking for an experience of God. We are actually God beings having human experience. And that just makes sense to me, that we are a part of the all there is. This cosmos is about mystery and infinity, and those concepts are as vast as God is. And I guess for me it makes more sense. It's comforting to me to feel like that I am a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not apart from, not separated from, but
And the ambiguity is okay. It is not unsettling to you.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. Faith is about reconciling the ambiguity.
Yeah, I guess you sort of have had to make peace with make that.
You do.
That's the whole rub. Yeah.
It is. It is. That belief in the absence of proof is what? Faith.
Mm-hmm. So we should just point out for those who don't know, this was going to be your thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were going to go into the priesthood.
Yeah, I studied for 4 years, yeah.
Did you, and it was that punitive God that
mm-hmm.
at that time,
mm-hmm.
you didn't have this bigger definition?
No, I did not. No, it was pretty, my concept of God was formed by the catechism of Catholicism and those precepts. And then as my world expanded and as my thirst for a deeper understanding of the world expanded, so did my idea of God expand.
That was LeVar Burton speaking to Wildcard host Rachel Martin. You can listen to more of that conversation by following the Wildcard podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That's all things considered for this Saturday. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210CR in Atchison, 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Saturday afternoon. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on After the Harvest, introducing Up, or Urban Produce Push, with a goal to provide produce to the people in pantries in every corner of Kansas City. More details on how to help at AfterTheHarvestKC.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, a low of 69. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 92, a 20% chance of showers Sunday night, lows in the mid-70s. And by Monday, sunny and hot with a high near 100. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Growing up as a kid, I went to summer camp, evangelical Christian summer camp, for a month every summer for 10 summers in a row. And it was exactly every stereotype you're thinking about right now. But I loved it.
Next up, the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told before a live audience. I'm Meg Bowles, and in this hour, we'll hear stories from Texas. Cowboys and big boys, NASA missions, and church camp.
And this girl comes along. She's, like, popular and pretty, so everyone listens to her. And she tells the entire camp that she's going to wait until her wedding day to have the first kiss of her life. Okay, do you understand that? Like, she's up the ante. We've all signed a purity pledge, but she's not going to kiss anyone until at the altar on her wedding day. So now this purity has become competitive.
That story and more coming up next on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX, right after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Thousands are expected to turn out for a Trump-Vance rally this evening in central Minnesota. Mark Sedeklik of Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Supporters of former President Donald Trump began pouring into a hockey arena on the campus of St. Cloud State University hours before the rally was set to begin.
I come to see the next president of the United States.
That's Edie Rosenberg, who drove to St. Cloud from a western Minneapolis suburb. Here's how she responded when asked what she likes about Trump.
He is common sense. He's for the American people. He's for the working people.
Trump is not the only one getting political attention in Minnesota. The state's governor, Tim Walz, is on the short list as a possible vice presidential candidate for Kamala Harris. For NPR News, I'm Mark Sedeklik in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
This is the first weekend on the campaign trail for Vice President Harris since President Biden dropped out of the race and lots of Democrats started throwing their support behind her. At a fundraiser in Pittsfield, Massachusetts today, she told the crowd that she focuses on the future while former President Trump focuses on the past, and she vows to beat him in November.
We have a fight ahead of us. We got a fight ahead of us. And we are the underdogs in this race. Okay? Level set. We're the underdogs in this race. But this is a people-powered campaign. And we have momentum.
Harris hopes to raise around $1.4 million today. The campaign says it took in more than $100 million in donations in the first 48 hours after Biden quit the race, a fundraising record. The Park Fire in Northern California is now at almost 350,000 acres. No fatalities or major injuries have been reported so far, but the blaze remains at 0% containment. From member station KQED, Catherine Monahan reports, firefighters are hoping calmer weather will help them gain ground.
Saturday's temperatures are forecast to be in the 80s, a welcome improvement from weeks of triple-digit heat. But as CAL FIRE spokesperson Rick Carhart points out, it's breezy, and the fire's towering smoke columns are drawing wind upward, making it hard for firefighters to know what to expect.
When the fire's creating its own weather, it's all unpredictable, and a lot of things just go out the window. Things happen that, you know, wouldn't normally happen.
Fire personnel are urging people to take all evacuation orders and warnings very seriously. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Monahan in Chico, California.
At the Summer Olympics in Paris, American swimmer Katie Ledecky took bronze in the women's 400-meter freestyle. It's her 11th Olympic medal and her first bronze. And divers Sarah Bacon and Cassidy Cook won the United States medal in the game, taking home the silver in the 3-meter synchronized springboard competition. China took the gold. Britain won the bronze. This is NPR News. And the U.S. men's soccer team bounced back at the Olympics after a disappointing opening loss to France. As NPR's Russell Lewis reports, the U.S. defeated New Zealand 4-1 in the second game of group play.
The U.S. game against New Zealand was critical for the Americans to have a chance to advance past group play at the Olympics. The U.S. dominated from beginning to end, scoring 3 goals in the first 30 minutes. Against gold medal favorite and host France in the opener, the U.S. didn't even find the net once. The American men have not played in an Olympics since 2008, and a loss against the Kiwis would have made their Olympic journey essentially all but over. The U.S. has a final game to play in their group against Guinea on Tuesday. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Paris.
In France, transportation officials say the high-speed rail networks have been partially restored after yesterday's arson attack ahead of the Olympics opening ceremony disrupted service to nearly 1 million riders. Crews had worked through the night in the rain to try to restore service to all the lines affected by that attack. The state-owned railway network, SNCF, says it hopes to have all of the service restored by Monday. No arrests have been made, nor have any suspects been identified in the arson attack on the railway system. SNCF says trackside signal boxes had been set on fire and cables on the lines had been cut, which caused major disruptions around the country. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Meg Bowles, and in this hour, we have 4 stories from our Moth events in El Paso, Houston, and Austin, Texas. A little context on the Lone Star State. It boasts a population of almost 29 million people. It's home to the Alamo, the birthplace of Dr. Pepper and jalapeno pepper jelly. Its official animal is the armadillo, and the state sport is rodeo. Our first 2 stories come from an open mic story slam we hosted in Houston. People from Houston seem quick to point out how sprawling it is, 647 square miles. Our first storyteller, Alyssa Ladd, who grew up there, said you can drive for hours and still be in Houston. Another big claim to fame, Houston was the very first word spoken on the moon. From the Warehouse Live at an evening sponsored by Houston Public Media, here's Alyssa Ladd live at the Moth.
Growing up as a kid, I went to summer camp. Evangelical Christian summer camp for a month every summer for 10 summers in a row. And it was exactly every stereotype you're thinking about right now. but I loved it. I was not evangelical Christian. I grew up Catholic, so it was kind of weird that I went there in the first place, but it had turned me into a freakishly religious kid, and I was obsessed with the idea of being a better Christian than everyone else around me. They had this award at the end of camp every year called the I'm Third Award, which meant that you put God first, others second, and I'm third. So essentially it was who is the most holy and the most selfless, and I wanted to win that goddamn award so bad. So because it's like evangelical Christians, like the main tenet of holiness is purity. And so they're obsessed with purity. All forms of touching the opposite sex were off limits at camp. You could only give a 3-second side hug. So like only the side of you could touch their side. None of the good stuff in the front. So we just bought this whole like purity package, like hook, line, and sinker. I'm like 14 years old this one summer. I'm trying to be the best Christian, the most pure, the most selfless. And this girl comes along. She's like popular and pretty, so everyone listens to her. And she tells the entire camp that she's going to wait until her wedding day to have the first kiss of her life. Okay, do you understand that? Like, she's up the ante. We've all signed a purity pledge, but she's not going to kiss anyone until at the altar on her wedding day. So now this purity has become competitive. And everyone else starts pledging that they're going to do the same thing. And like, how am I going to win this award if I don't do the same thing, right? Well, there's a problem. And his name is Seth. So we've been camp boyfriend, girlfriend for like 3 summers now. I'm not sure he had much to do with that. I just saw a very timid 12-year-old boy who was like blonde and could do a backflip. And I was just like, mine. We're dating now. But here we were 3 years later, and we'd been spending the entire past year on AOL Instant Messenger talking every day, plotting how we were going to have our first kiss at camp that summer. So here's how we were going to do it. Once a summer, they take you to a water park, and if our cabins could go on the same day, then one of those slides was for a 2-person inner tube. And if we could get in the same inner tube, then a few seconds of that ride... we're enclosed. So we were going to kiss. It was going to be our first kiss as a couple, his first kiss of his entire life, no pressure. We did not factor in how fast water slides are. So the minute or the second I turn around to kiss him, we both fall out of the tube, but he is still like coming in hot for these lips, okay? So he bites my upper lip, draws blood. Not romantic, but definite lip contact. So we counted it as a first kiss. So a week goes by, I hear nothing. And then I hear over the whole camp intercom, Alyssa Ladd come to the camp office. And I had to meet with the camp disciplinarian, who, by the way, is like 23 years old. Like, could, but it was very scary at the time. And I'm freaking out because I want to win this award. I've like, never been in trouble. I'm a goody two-shoes. But I get there, and he's nowhere to be seen. So I'm like, they don't know about this kiss. And she's like, we know about you and Seth. And I was like, don't panic. Just, like, reveal nothing. She will tell you what she knows. Because that was a good freaking plan. There's no way anyone saw us on that water slide. And I just said to her, well, if we're both in trouble, where's Seth? And she says... oh, well, Seth's not in trouble because it's the girl who makes the boy stumble on his walk with the Lord. I was like, okay, that sounds about right. And, of course, she didn't know about the water slide. I was in trouble because a counselor had seen Seth and I holding hands the night before and turned us in. She told me that holding hands with Seth was not saving myself or my future husband. And if we were caught fraternizing again, I and I alone would be in trouble, and I would go to the Hilton, which is the ironic name for the tent in the woods where you went if you were bad. And you ran up and down hills and hosed out trash cans and worked in the kitchen. And I was like pretty sure God didn't have a problem with me holding hands, but I really didn't want to go to the Hilton. So Seth and I broke up. Publicly. I never did win the I'm Third Award, but Seth and I kissed like 3 more times at camp and I never got caught.
Alyssa Ladd went to camp, which she has left nameless, from ages 7 to 17. Her last year, she and Seth were elected by their peers as leaders of the camp, so she doesn't think holding hands tarnished their reputations too badly. They stopped being a couple when they were 14, but they're still friends. He now lives with his wife and son in Chicago and works as a journalist, and Alyssa is a corporate lawyer in her hometown of Houston. She says she's no longer trying to out-Christian everyone. She's just trying to be a good person. Our next story, also from our Houston Story Slam, comes from Chris Gorman, who moved from her small town in Beaumont, Texas, to the big city of Houston in 1989. She says it feels like everyone in the city is from somewhere else, between the Space Center and the Texas Medical Center and the different artistic and business communities. There are people from all over the world. But in spite of its transient culture, or maybe as a result of it, she says there's a surprisingly strong sense of community. Here's Chris Gorman, live at the Moth.
I don't like nice, easy things. So when I went down to the SPCA to pick out a dog, and I saw one in a cage that just said unwanted, I thought that one might be a fit. And then when they called me in a week and said he was on rabies hold, that's when I knew that was going to be my dog. And let me get this straight right at the start. I'm not a dog mom. I've looked deep inside. I'm not a nurturing person. But at the time, I was turning 40, and I looked around for my friends, and there wasn't anybody there. So, yeah, I was going to get a dog. And as soon as they said I couldn't have that dog, I wanted him twice as much. And as soon as I got Big Boy home, he let me know right away why it said unwanted on his cage. Big Boy had two things that get dogs returned to the shelter in a hurry. He had fear aggression and separation anxiety. Fear aggression just meant that he would bite you if you looked at him. If you looked at him, or if you weren't looking at him. And separation anxiety meant that I got a phone call from the police. My neighbors called the police because Big Boy was in my apartment making a noise that you could hear from outer space. And the police were just curious as to what kind of animals I was sacrificing inside my apartment. So I ran home from work, and I popped open the door for the police, and I said, look, he's just watching TV. And he was, and he was making a noise that you could hear from outer space. So I dialed the vet, and I held the phone up, and I said, listen to this. And she said, oh, you don't have to hold up the phone. We can hear it from here. And I said, I can't keep this dog. But I knew I couldn't really take him back either. Dogs that go back to the animal shelter very seldom come back out again, and I had failed at most things I had tried up to that point. So this needed to be a win for the both of us. So I sat down with the vet, and I said, I don't know what to do. And she goes, well, I can recommend our mental health care program. And I said, mental health. And she goes, no, seriously, we have dogs that come every day to our mental health care program. So this became our lifestyle. Every morning I would pack Big Boy up like he was a luggage going to the airport. I'd take him to the vet, drop him on the carousel, go work 9 hours, and then come back in the evening time to pick him up. He'd run joyously out of the back from where the cages were, straight to somebody else. I would take him from them and take him home. I did that every weekday for 5 years. And then he got sick. And he was at the vet for a real reason, for a change. And he's back there in a cage with his name on it. I mean, he came there every single day. And there was a new vet. She wanted to try to get to know him a little bit. And she went back there to put her hand in to pet him. And a worker stopped her and said, oh, no, don't touch him. That's Big Boy. He's not nice. But in the next breath, the worker said, yeah, but you're going to fix him, right? You're going to make him better, right? She didn't have any idea what was wrong with him. It was like being on an episode of House. Every day there was a different differential diagnosis and another $400 bill. And then it got severe. And she called me and she's like, hey, I think you should take him home. There's not much we can do for him here. So they sent me home with an IV bag and a broken dog. And I remember I went in and I laid him on the kitchen floor. And I hung the IV bag on the kitchen cabinet and I sat down with him and I said, sir, I'm sorry. I don't have any special skills. I got nothing for you here. But then I took all the love that I had inside me. I mean, for things that I love, like ice cream, fireworks, my sister. And I remember I put it in my hands. And it was weird. It felt kind of like a warm substance. And then I just applied it directly to the dog. And then I took him back in a couple days. She took him to the back, and she comes back out, and she goes, he's better? So let's do today. The vet did find out some things that was wrong with Big Boy. He's in triple overtime now. And he's blind. And all the things that used to make him so angry and frightened about the world, he can't see them anymore. I have a nice dog now. And what's weird is I feel really nostalgic for those times when I had all that adrenaline, when we were just trying to be together. But I know that if I have a 3-day weekend or an extra day off, we're going to take him on his last trip to the beach again. We've taken him so many times now. And I know that once I get him on the beach, I'm going to sit down with him and I'm going to say, Big Boy, even though I was never your mother, I really enjoyed being your lawyer and your publicist, your Uber driver, and your hazmat team. And I know that we'll just keep taking him on his last trip to the beach until it's his last trip to the beach.
That was Chris Gorman. Chris works as a pharmacy tech in Houston's Third Ward. And she may have been a loner, but when she first met her dog, that all began to change. Big Boy introduced her to a lot of new people. From meeting the folks at the West Alabama Animal Clinic, whose support made it possible for her to even adopt him in the first place, to friendships made at the dog park where she would take Big Boy to socialize and run around. One of the friends she made there became a best friend, who also happens to be a fan of our open mic story slams in Houston, where Chris has since met a whole new community. Coming up, the story of a little reported NASA security breach when the Moth Radio Hour continues. This show is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance. From car insurance quotes to buying, Progressive Insurance offers a variety of ways to stay protected. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from I2S at KU. Addressing the social impacts of emerging technologies and how to be human in a technologically complex age. More information at i2s-research.ku.edu. And Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing independent energy systems such as backup batteries and solar panels for farms, homes, and businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, a low of 69. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 92, a 20% chance of showers tomorrow night, lows in the mid-70s. You're listening to KPR.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles. Our next story comes from El Paso, Texas, which stands on the Rio Grande across the U.S.-Mexico border from Juarez. And a few miles north is the border with New Mexico, where our next storyteller grew up. Robert Olguin is a journalist and local news anchor at KFOX 14 in El Paso. And he shared his story at a main stage event we produced with a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. The theme of the night was Eyewitness. Here's Robert Olguin live at the Moth.
Space travel used to be a pretty big deal. I mean, it's still a big deal. But back before Sir Richard Branson started talking about space tourism, going in and out of Earth's orbit was newsworthy. People paid attention, especially when it came to the space shuttle. In the 1980s, this thing was revolutionary. It blew people's minds. It blew my mind. So imagine when I'm 12 years old, I get a phone call from my uncle. And he says, hey, you want to go see the space shuttle land? And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, the space shuttle, it's going to land at White Sands tomorrow. Do you want to go see it land? My uncle was a state policeman in New Mexico. He was in charge of the governor's security. So the governor and my uncle were going to see the space shuttle land at White Sands Missile Range the next day, and they were asking me if I wanted to tag along. So for a sixth grader who was a big fan of Star Trek, this was a no-brainer. Of course I wanted to see the space shuttle. But for my parents, it wasn't quite so clear-cut. You see, I wasn't a very good student. Truth be told, I was a pretty lousy student. I never did my homework. I always talked in class. I never studied for tests. So my parents didn't want to reward this kind of behavior by letting me skip school, even if it meant that their son would get to see a spaceship land in the desert. So I begged, I pleaded, I made promises about changing my ways, and they relented. So the next morning, on March 29th, 1982, I was on a date with destiny. I was in the back seat of an unmarked police car. My Uncle John was driving. We finally arrived at headquarters at White Sands Missile Range, about 2 hours north of my hometown there in New Mexico. And there was my uncle's boss, Governor Bruce King. If you can imagine, he's a big, boisterous politician. I remember he was wearing a polyester suit and cowboy boots. He was working the room, shaking everyone's hand. He shook my hand. It was a big day for Governor King. This was about the future of space exploration. Now, back in those days, there was only one space shuttle, the Columbia. It had been in space for 7 days. It had a crew of two, and it was supposed to have landed at Edwards Air Force Base. It always landed at Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert. But the landing strip there had been rained out. So the secondary site, an alternate site, was White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Now, White Sands wasn't dealing with rain, but it was dealing with wind, like intense wind. The kind of wind that sent grains of white sand deep into my eye sockets and ear canals. The kind of wind that would make it very difficult for anyone to pilot and glide a 165,000-pound spacecraft back down to the desert floor. I remember being fascinated by that particular element. The space shuttle would glide back to Earth. No second chances. You had to get it right the first time. So anyways, we stood there. The hours kept slipping by. The dignitaries had gotten sandblasted off the aluminum bleachers, and they had retreated to headquarters. I remember feeling a sinking feeling in my stomach because I could see the military guys talking to my uncle. They were talking about the wind. They were saying it was just too strong. And then finally, several hours later, the official word came on my uncle's radio. The landing had been canceled. The mission was scrubbed because of the winds. I remember learning that word that day, scrubbed, and it seemed appropriate because for a 12-year-old with a NASA vest from Kmart, it felt like my heart had been scrubbed with a wire brush. The guys from NASA said, don't worry, they're going to try again tomorrow. They're just going to extend the mission by one day. They'll try to land again tomorrow. Hopefully it won't be as windy. On the car ride back home, I was heartbroken and I was silent because it didn't matter that NASA was going to try again tomorrow because I knew that my parents weren't going to let me skip school for a second day. So my uncle dropped me off at home. He said, good luck with that. He knew what was up. I went in the house, and my parents had already heard the news on the news that the landing had been delayed by one day. And before I could even begin my sales pitch, my dad was like, nope, no way. It's not going to happen. You're not missing school again. Missing school wasn't that big a deal, but remember, I got terrible grades. I'm the one that refused to study. So even at 12, I knew this was on me. This was my fault. So I retreated back to my bedroom, stared at the ceiling, and daydreamed about what a landing might have looked like. And then in the kitchen, I could overhear my sister coming to my defense. She was lobbying on my behalf. And that was an interesting development because brother-sister relations weren't exactly good back then. But I heard her say a short speech, something about the historic significance of the event, and then she said, kind of wrapping it up, "Qué gacho," which translates roughly to "how sad." And the shame worked, I suppose, because eventually my mom came around, and then my dad let up, and so they let me go. So the next day I was back in that unmarked police car on my way to White Sands Missile Range. When we got to the landing strip, the weather was perfect, and I decided to strike out on my own. And that's when I started to notice all of the photographers and all of the cameras and all of the reporters and all the people holding microphones. I started to notice the stages that they had built in the desert with lights hanging from rigging. The world was watching. You could tell the excitement was building. Then the official word came over the loudspeaker. The Columbia was coming home. The photographers trained their lenses to the sky. Everyone started to point. And there it was off in the distance, just a tiny white speck. We heard the thunderous sonic boom, which, again, I thought was thunder, but the shuttle was traveling faster than the speed of sound. As it made its descent, it was flanked by two fighter jets, and the Columbia looked nothing like the fighter jets. They were sleek and agile. The Columbia was kind of bulky and cumbersome and silent as it made its final approach and landed effortlessly in the desert. It whizzed past us, and I broke out my Instamatic camera and took some photos. Then I noticed that all of the photographers and reporters that I'd seen earlier were standing way off in the distance, much closer to the shuttle than the rest of us. In fact, they were standing really close to where the astronauts would be standing. And so I began to wonder, why are they over there and we're over here? I decided I was just going to walk over there with them. I had no idea that you had to be credentialed to be in that area, or at least an adult. But I just decided to walk right alongside those cool photographers and reporters I'd met earlier, and I walked right into the press conference. It was a chaotic press conference, if you can imagine, out in the desert floor, two astronauts trying to answer questions. So I just kind of weaseled my way up front, and before I knew it, I was standing right next to the pilot, Gordon Fullerton. And I started snapping pictures with my little Instamatic. And he's trying to answer questions, and I decide, hey, I want to ask a question. So I chose my moment, and then I said, now remember, he's standing right next to me. Hey, what did it feel like to be in space? A confused look came over his face. Remember, Gordon Fullerton had just re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, so he's trying to come to terms with why a 12-year-old is asking him questions. He didn't answer my question, he just sort of laughed. And that's when NASA security noticed that a 12-year-old had entered a restricted area, and they escorted me right out of the press conference back to where everyone else was standing, far from the action. I didn't get a quote, but I did get a photo, fairly decent photo, of Gordon Fullerton. The Columbia would go on to take part in several missions, but the Columbia would fall off the front page. The missions became routine over the years. Until February of 2003. That's when the Columbia disintegrated over the skies of Texas. I was coming to work that day. I was working for a TV station here in El Paso. And the assignment desk called me and told me about what had happened. It was a national tragedy, but to me it was personal. That same spaceship that I had seen land effortlessly in the desert just evaporated like a falling star. All seven crew members were killed. I remember going through my old photos of the Columbia to try to show them on the news that night. I remember that day at White Sands to me signified the space program's ability to adapt, to overcome, and come out on top. But not on that day. The Columbia story would end in disaster. I would have one more opportunity to cover the shuttle program, as the shuttle program was coming to an end. I was a television reporter in Los Angeles. And one of the last surviving shuttles, the Endeavour, was being turned into a museum piece. But first, they had to get it to the museum. So the only way to do that was to drive it through the streets of L.A. like a $4 billion parade float. I remember working with a photographer that day. His name was Steve, and he was one of those cool cameramen, just like the ones I had met out in the desert in 1982. He and I couldn't stop but laugh at the spectacle of what we were seeing. We were seeing a spaceship cruise through the streets of South Central. But on that day, everybody was celebrating. Everybody was happy. Everyone cared about the shuttle again. As the Endeavour passed by, I grabbed a selfie of myself with the Endeavor in the background. It was better than the photos I took of the Columbia, but the idea was the same. Everyone else was watching on TV, but I was right there next to the action, and I got my shot.
Robert Olguin is a journalist and filmmaker and currently the evening news anchor for KFOX 14 in El Paso, Texas, just down the road from Vado, New Mexico, where he grew up. Robert said he was surprised he got choked up when telling his story, but talking about that memory in front of all those people, he was suddenly hit by emotion, thinking of the lives that were lost. Recently, some of the artifacts from the Columbia shuttle were transported to the University of Texas, El Paso, so students can study the disaster. Robert has asked for permission to view the artifacts so he can research and hopefully tell another chapter of the story. You can see a picture of Robert with the Space Shuttle Columbia on our website, themoth.org. Coming up, a man's answer to a call for help turns his own life upside down when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, featuring Kansas City jazz music, cocktails, wine, and beer. Live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Information at greenladylounge.com. And Kansas City PBS, discussing the week's top stories with newsmakers and guest experts on Week in Review, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. More information at kansascitypbs.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, 20% chance of showers, partly cloudy, a low of 69. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 92, 20% chance of showers Sunday night, with lows in the mid-70s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles, and our last story, told live on stage in Texas, comes from Christopher Scott. Christopher grew up in Oak Cliff, a neighborhood of Dallas. He describes himself as the baby of nine siblings, spoiled rotten. He said they didn't have a lot, but he remembers making toys together with his brothers and sisters, go-karts and slingshots, and they were always so proud of what they made. From the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas, here's Christopher Scott, live at the Moth.
Sundays in my home was like this. We washed cars, we washed clothes, and also we watched the Dallas Cowboys play. Yeah. But this particular Sunday, I got a phone call from a friend of mine that was struggling with drugs. He had a real bad problem with drugs. And I told him then, whenever you need to talk to somebody about drugs and your addiction, to give me a call, to somebody a call that doesn't use drugs. That night I didn't want to leave my home, but I did. Because just imagine if this guy came to you and told you he was struggling, and you would have been the last person that he talked to if anything had happened to him or he did something to someone else. So I left. I drove to my friend's house. I pulled up in his driveway. He got in my car. We rode around the block a couple of times. And I was telling him, you have to do better because drug addiction is serious. It kills people. It ruins people's lives. I never did drugs because I knew exactly what it did to people. It destroyed a lot of lives that I knew of. So we drove to 7-Eleven and got a couple of sodas. On the way back to his home, driving down the street, a helicopter flying over pushed the spotlight right on top of my car. And I'm wondering, like, what's going on? As I'm continuing to drive, we pass a cop. The cop does a U-turn. So we drive up into my friend's yard and go into the house. Next thing you know, the house is surrounded by cops. We see a lot of flashlights shining inside of the windows. I'm wondering what's going on. I don't know. Eventually, we let the cops in. They escort all of us out of the house. As they lay us on the ground, they go get random African-American men that looks like me and lay them on the side of the ground with me. Eventually, the cops walks up to me, points, and say, "You, come here." I get up. I walk to the van. I hold my hands out. They pour some liquid substance inside of my hand, and it drops into a bag. After that, they arrest 25 of us. They escort us to the police station. When we get, they put 25 individuals on one side and have me on one side by myself, shackled and handcuffed to a bench. I'm sitting in front of a big glass window. A female officer walks the lady up to the window. Now, I couldn't hear, but I could read her lips. She said, "This is the man that killed your husband." And she said, "Yes, that's him." I had never seen this lady a day in my life ever before. The cops take me to interrogation room. They question me, "Where do you get your drugs from?" I tell them, "I'm not a drug seller." And they ask me again, "Where do you get your drugs from?" "Sir, I am not a drug seller." And they say, "Yeah, we found out that you was a drug dealer kingpin." I say, "No, sir, I'm not a drug dealer kingpin." "What drug dealer kingpin do you know work at a local grocery store?" "I don't know any." And then I ask him, "Just go outside and ask the officers that's in the hallway. They will vouch for me. They come and shop at the same store that I work at. I give all of these officers fresh fruit and fresh vegetables." But they still don't believe me. A matter of seconds later, they saying, you are being charged with capital murder. I say, "Capital murder? You mean I went from being a drug dealer kingpin to having a capital murder case?" So I go to trial and go in the court building, and the judge tells me that I'm being convicted of capital murder. But understand this, those same officers that I said vouched for me came to my trial and vouched for me and said there's no way I could have committed this crime. Even the ballistic report came back to show I never fired a gun. But I was still convicted of capital murder. The judge looked at me and slammed the gavel down hard. Said, "You are now sentenced to capital life sentence in prison. You'll be eligible for parole in 40 years. And I thought about it for a second. Like, why am I in this position? Why is this even happening to me? How am I going to be able to tell my 4 and 5 year old kids that they would never see their dad again? So now, I'm on my way to prison. It's cold, it's raining, it's dark. And I pull up, I see a big prison with a lot of windows. As I exit the prison van, I step out. I'm shackled, handcuffed, like a slave. I look up into the sky. I see a correctional officer on a gun tower with an AK-47 pointed directly at me. And I looked at that prison again. I said this. I would never ever leave this prison again. My first day there, I walk into the shower. As I'm walking into the shower, I saw a guy get stabbed at least 7 times. And there's a TDC officer going, watching the whole thing. And didn't do anything. Not one single thing. As I walk more into the shower, I hear a grown man scream. So loud, so perverse, it scared me. When I go back to my cell that night, I laid in my bed thinking, am I going to lose my sanity? Will I be the same man again that I came in as? I actually had to think about survival. What am I going to do? What's going to happen to me? I didn't think I was going to survive. I couldn't even sleep that first night. That same morning, about 4:30, I come back to my cell from breakfast. It's time to go to the fields. And the fields is where we got to go do our work. They gave me an Aggie, which we all know is a grubbing hoe. They gave me a bag and some seeds. So we turn over the soil, you plant the seeds, cover back up the dirt. My hands are covered with blisters because I didn't know how to hold the Aggie. They was raw. I mean, like really, really raw. As I go back into my prison, an inmate stops me and gives me some advice about what I should do. So eventually, I save up enough money to buy me some gloves from the commissary to protect my hands, because they didn't give you gloves there. I started writing letters to my family. And my family never visited me while I was in prison because I didn't want them to. Because you know how they say, out of sight, out of mind. Their life didn't stop because mine stopped. Their life kept going and I was in prison. I started writing and working on my case as soon as I was eligible. 5 years into my sentence, my brother wrote me a letter stating that he had information of a guy that actually committed this crime. This guy was on the same unit as my brother because my brother was incarcerated for criminal mischief and criminal trespass. So this guy came in a barbershop where my brother worked, boasting and bragging that him and his friend had robbed and killed a Hispanic drug dealer, and there was 2 other guys in prison for that crime. Little did that guy know, he was confessing to my own brother. The guy said, well, I didn't think that they was going to charge him with this case, but I still was found guilty. So my brother convinced the guy to sign an affidavit to help me go free. But once we sent to our district attorney's office, the district attorney said, this case has no DNA in it. We don't want to ever hear about this case again. This case is closed. So don't never reach out to me about this case ever again, because it's over with. I question God on a regular, like, why you put me in this position? What did I do so terrible that I have to struggle and go through this? My mom prayed for me. My church prayed for me. And my mama, she always said, if you had a faith the size of a mustard seed, it would move mountains. Because there's one thing about hope in prison. It's a commodity. You gotta have it. You gotta have it. Eventually, we got the first African-American district attorney in the state of Texas history, which was Craig Watkins. I wrote Craig Watkins a letter, told him about my case. And he took it to the University of Texas of Arlington. Maybe a month later, I get a letter from the district attorney's office. And when I opened up this letter, I was so terrified because I knew my life was inside of this letter. Either I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison or I'm going to go free. So I opened up this letter and I had a glimmer, not a lot, but a glimmer of hope. After I read that letter, I sealed it and put it up under my pillow. 2 weeks later, I walked into that visitation room and I saw my mom. She had gotten older, had this tired look on her face, but I always had this bright, beautiful smile that lit up the room. I never ever wanted her to see me in this place or be in this position. So when I walked up to her, I embraced my mom with a good hug and a kiss on her cheek. And it reminded me of being a kid when I was going to school. I remember this perfume that she used to wear. It was called opium. Now, a lot of y'all probably don't know about it if you're 21 and younger, but if you're 50 or above, you know what opium is. That's a great perfume for older ladies, I'm sorry. But my mama told me this, and this is the first time I ever had hope that I was going to get out of prison. She said, baby, you're going to take a polygraph test, and you will be home. Mama would never ever see her baby boy in his white uniform again. Maybe a month later, I walked into this court building. The court building is filled just like this room right here, filled to the capacity of people. It wasn't enough seats in there because majority of all the newscasters was there to see the first person to ever be exonerated without knowing DNA in Dallas County's history. Next thing you know, the judge hit the gavel. Boom. Mr. Scott, you are found actual innocent. You are free to go. That 13 years I did for a crime I didn't commit, that 13 years of pressure, that 13 years of burden was finally lifted. As I walked outside thinking, it's finally over. I finally have my freedom. And there's one thing that I wanted to do is make sure I would never ever be put in this position ever again. I wasn't the same man when I walked into prison as I walked out. I was more focused. I was more dedicated. Before I went to prison, I didn't cherish the smaller things in life. But now that I had my freedom, I was able to go to the refrigerator when I wanted to. Go to the mailbox when I wanted to. Take a long walk outside when I wanted to. I used to take that for granted. I really did. But now, I don't take it for granted anymore. Now, I cherish everything about that. Thank you all.
Christopher Scott is the president and founder of House of Renewed Hope. When Christopher was in prison, he met other men with the same story as his, who looked a lot like him. And so he, along with some fellow inmates, started investigating cases to help find evidence that might exonerate other innocent people. They also identified laws that should be changed to prevent this from happening to anyone else. And they vowed whoever got out first would start lobbying. Christopher was released in 2010, and that's exactly what he did and continues to do through his work with House of Renewed Hope. Samuel James, who's a journalist and frequent Moth storyteller, shared the stage with Christopher that night in Austin, and he talked to him more about his story.
On October 24th, you have a big anniversary coming up?
Yeah. And, you know, it's a big anniversary like twice that month because October the 9th is like my 50th birthday. So I've been to celebrate that out in society. And then that same month is my anniversary of wrongful conviction. Now, it's crazy. My birthday, October the 9th, you know, I got exonerated October the 24th. So October is a big, you know, is a great month for me. So I try to cherish and celebrate October, that whole 31 days.
It's good to get a long month to celebrate it.
That's nice. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure I changed. I got 31 instead of 28 or 30. I got 31 days in my month.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Earlier you were telling me about how you get up in the morning, and this it'll be 10 years in October.
Right.
But it seems like some ways it doesn't feel like 10 years to you.
No, the time has went by so fast because I've done so much in a 10-year time frame that it seemed like, man, I just got out 2-3 years ago because time has went by so fast. I can't believe it because 1 minute I'm just getting out, you know, thanking the judge and my attorney and the law student that helped me get exonerated. And not only them, my attorney, Michelle Moore, as well. Now, you know, it's all the same because a lot of these people are still in my life. So it makes that transition that much better and that much easier because having the people that saw you and helped you get exonerated 10 years ago and still to have them around, it's an amazing feeling.
I can't imagine. Can't imagine. You were also saying that you're an early bird.
I'm up about 5:45, 6 o'clock every morning.
What? Why do you get up so early?
I still have that prison-like schedule as waking up early in the morning, having things that I have prepared for that day. So I just been stuck on that same schedule. I'm still stuck in that time. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's like that alarm clock goes off and boom, I'm up and I'm wide awake. Like I said, that's the most time I do my best thinking. That's when I'm like the cases that I work on, I can pay a lot of more attention to them because really at that time, that's the time I do my most thinking and better thinking as in the morning times. Because in prison, that's when prison was the most quiet, early in the morning. So it gave you a sense of peace. And that's what I look for in the morning when I get up. I just want that peaceness and I want that calmness about me and about, you know, the world. But it's one thing I do. I usually walk out of my back door. And the first thing I do, I always listen to a bird chirping because it's like they know exactly what time I come out every morning. And it's like those birds just be sitting right there waiting on me to come out.
It's beautiful.
You can hear more of Samuel James' interview with Christopher Scott on our website, themoth.org. You can also re-listen or share the stories you heard in this hour and find out about upcoming live events. That's at themoth.org. That's it for this episode. We hope you'll join us again next time for the Moth Radio Hour.
Your host this hour was Meg Bowles. Meg also directed the stories in the show. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Janess, and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Emily Couch. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Charlie Hayden and Hank Jones, Duke Levine, Smokin' Joe Kubek and Benoist King, Keith Jarrett, Jan Gabarek, and Paulie Danielson and John Christensen. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, Eric, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. And Kansas Tree Care, local arborists who provide professional tree care in the greater Lawrence area and who can be reached at kansastreecare.com or at 785-843-TREE. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3, KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3, online at kansaspublicradio.org.
The great jazz guitarist Wes Montgomery once said, "I never practice my guitar. From time to time, I just open the case and throw in a piece of raw meat." Well, we've got some raw meat for lovers of jazz guitar today on Live at Green Lady Lounge. I'm David Bassey, and we're about to hear from Wiretown, a Kansas City all-star quartet featuring two of the city's best guitar pickers, Danny Embry and Rod Fleeman, joined by bassist Gerald Spates and Brian Stever at the drums. It's Wiretown, live at Green Lady Lounge.
Hello. Welcome to the Green Lady Lounge. And we're called Wiretown because we got a lot of wires up here. Even the drums have wires. Yeah, see, there's the wires. And we're going to start out with a song called Jammin' at 627.
Thank you.
Jamming at 627. That's dedicated to the local musicians union. 627. Down at 18th and Highland.
Mm-hmm.